You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks. I know you love podcasts, and March is National Podcast Month. Believe it or not, there are a lot of people out there who still haven't been turned on to podcasts or don't really know what a podcast is. So help celebrate Podcast Month by sharing Kick-Ass News or any of your favorite podcasts with at least two friends. Or better yet, share us with all your friends on Twitter or Facebook and be sure to tag us when you do and use the hashtag Tripod. That's TRYPOD. Spread the word about this podcast or any podcast. And if you want to do something else to support Kick-Ass News, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews. Believe it or not, this show costs actual money, and your contribution will help offset some of those costs. So become a part of what I'm doing here by going to GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews and making a donation. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the podcast. Why are we here? It is both the most fundamentally human question and fundamentally frustrating question we ask ourselves. Who hasn't wondered where we come from and what it all means? But what if we're asking the wrong questions? And what if it's not all about us? My guest today has some thoughts on the subject. In fact, he's at the forefront of the quest to discover where we came from, and not just why, but how we're here. Professor Lawrence M. Krauss is an internationally known theoretical physicist and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, a national center for research and outreach on origins issues, from the origins of the universe and human origins to the origins of consciousness and culture. He's also the foundation professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and the physics department at ASU, where his research includes the interface between elementary particle physics and cosmology, the early universe, the nature of dark matter, general relativity, and neutrino astrophysics. Prior to coming to ASU, Lawrence Krauss served as the Ambrose Swayze Professor of Physics, Professor of Astronomy, and Chairman of the Department of Physics at Case Western Reserve University. During his 12 years at Case, he built up their physics department into one of the top 20 ranked physics graduate research programs in the country. He's also the only physicist to have received awards from all three major American physics societies: the American Physical Society, the American Association of Physics Teachers, and the American Institute of Physics. And he's received the National Science Board's Public Service Medal for his contributions to public education in science and engineering. He's the author of more than 300 scientific publications and 9 books, including The Fifth Essence, The Search for Dark Matter in the Universe, the number one New York Times bestseller, The Physics of Star Trek and its follow-up, Beyond Star Trek, Adam, An Odyssey from the Big Bang to Life on Earth and Beyond, Hiding in the Mirror, The Mysterious Allure of Extra Dimensions from Plato to String Theory and Beyond, and his last book, A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing, which also reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Today, he's joining me on the podcast to talk about his newest book, The Greatest Story Ever Told, So Far. Why Are We Here? He'll discuss the questions we should be asking ourselves. He'll also talk about why technological advances and new gadgets shouldn't always be the end game of science, and why we human beings may need to get over our need to believe that the whole universe was created just for us. He'll give a history of science that he says is way more interesting than the Bible and discuss some of the seminal figures in that history. He'll also take on intelligent design, Deepak Chopra, and Donald Trump in the process. Plus, he'll reveal why the organization he chairs just moved the infamous doomsday clock a lot closer to midnight. Coming up with theoretical physicist Professor Lawrence M. Krauss in just a moment. We'll be right back. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson has called renowned theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss the Bard of the Universe. He's director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, chair of the Board of Sponsors at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and the only physicist to have received awards from all three major American physics societies, the American Physical Society, the American Association of Physics Teachers, and the American Institute of Physics, as well as receiving the National Science Board's Public Service Medal for his contributions to public education in science and engineering. Lawrence Krauss is the author of more than 300 scientific publications and 9 books, including the international bestsellers A Universe from Nothing and The Physics of Star Trek. His newest book is causing quite a stir. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? Professor Krauss, thanks so much for joining me.
It's good to be here.
Well, like I said, your latest book is called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? That last part is something that seems to be so basic to human nature. Why am I here? Why does the universe exist? But you say we're asking the wrong question. We should actually be asking how, not why. So
well, I think
why
I'm
how?
Saying, well, I'm thinking that most of the time, what I really meant by that is that most of the time when we say why, we really mean how.
Mm-hmm.
When we say, why is the sky blue, we don't really mean the, because why has sort of suggests the intent of purpose. Why presumes mm-hmm. purpose? And we don't assume that there's some purpose. We really care about why is the sky blue, we really mean how is it that light, when it refracts through the atmosphere, turns blue? Why does my heart beat? It's only when it comes to these fundamental questions do we think that do we say why do we exist? Do we presume purpose? And it's often because of religion that we presume there's a purpose. But what if there's no purpose? Then the question makes no sense.
Yeah.
So really, I think the important questions are, how did the universe come into being? How are we here? And maybe that'll address for some people the why questions that so much people really want to ask, because we're sort of hardwired to want to assume purpose.
Yeah, and here in the inside book flap of your book, it says, this book challenges readers to re-envision ourselves and our place within the universe. So if we're going to advance forward as a species, do we need to get past this narcissistic need to be the center of the universe and to believe that everything that is was created entirely for our benefit?
I agree. I mean, I think it's the most solipsistic view of the universe you can imagine. And to imagine that if the universe isn't made for us, then it's useless. Or if there's no purpose to the universe, then our own purpose doesn't exist. It's both ways. It's kind of incredibly self-centered. And there may be no purpose to the universe, but we make our own purpose in life. And in fact, if we're here as a cosmic accident, as I argue in the book in great detail, I think it makes the accident of our existence more precious, and we should try and take advantage of the fact that we evolved brains and we are here to be aware of the universe in which we live. And it's an amazing thing, and we should try and utilize that and our brains to the best of our capabilities, and since we can control our environment, to make the future better than the past.
You start the book by saying, in the beginning there was light, but more than that, there was gravity. After that, all hell broke loose. You make a lot of these allusions to Christianity, even with the title, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. You start each chapter with relevant Bible verses, and you even have the book broken down into Genesis, Exodus, and Revelations. Are you trying to draw parallels with religion? Are you trying to be sardonic or provide an alternative narrative to religion?
Well, I'm not trying to draw parallels. I think I'm sort of making a somewhat tongue-in-cheek relation. The greatest story ever told was a story, is often attributed to the Bible stories. And I want to argue is that the real story of the universe is really the greatest story ever told. And moreover, the so far part is the key part, because our story keeps changing. It gets better every day because it gets bigger and better and we get surprised. And so I really was trying to make a comparison, a sense, but it's not comparable because the Bible can't compare to this story. It's not even as interesting.
In your previous book, A Universe from Nothing, you said that recent science suggests that the universe could and plausibly did arise from nothing, which of course goes against the creation myth and even calls into question the existence of a higher power. Do you see this book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, as a companion piece to A Universe from Nothing?
Yeah, in a way. The Universe of Nothing did two things. First of all, it explored the revolutionary developments that have taken place on the largest scales that we know of, and which are truly revolutionary, and which have changed the way we think about ourselves. And they also have allowed us to address this transcendental question, which has been usurped by religion, why is there something rather than nothing, which religion claimed to have an answer for, which is simply God did it, and claimed that science could never answer. And the point is we've come up with a plausible argument without any supernatural shenanigans. This book explores the other realm of scientific forefront, which is understanding the universe on the smallest scales. And there have also been revolutionary developments in the last 50 years that are not truly appreciated among the public. And I wanted to tell that amazing intellectual story of that of how we got to where we are. But in turn, that story also has implications for the other transcendental question, which is why are we here?
And your book tells this sweeping narrative of the history of science. When does the story of science begin? What is the Genesis chapter, if you
well,
will?
Well, there's a section of the book called Genesis. But my story, in some sense, originates with Plato, not because he was necessarily a scientist, but he presented a view of reality in his allegory of the cave, that we're all sort of seeing the shadows of reality, and the job of the scientist is to understand the reality beneath the shadows. And I think that is a very good analogy for what science has been doing over the last 2,000 years. Modern science probably began with Galileo, in my opinion. And in fact, he plays a part in the story, as does Newton and beyond. And that story is the story of the best of humanity at its best, trying to answer these questions. And while scientists themselves may be biased and prejudiced about what they think the answers are, what's great is that science overcomes those biases and prejudices. And eventually, even though people may be going down the wrong alley for a long time, it eventually turns them around. And I find that process, the process of science, is incredibly important for cutting through the illusion that is the world we see. And therefore, I think it has applications to actually the political world we live in, too, where I think we need to turn to empirical reality to cut through the illusions that we're hearing about in politics.
Yeah. There was a long period when science and religion were intertwined. To a large extent, scientific inquiry was pursued as a means of understanding God. You talk about Sir Isaac Newton's study of the Bible code and alchemy and mysticism at the same time as he was formulating his laws of motion and gravity. When was the break where science really became its own discipline, separate of the mysticism and alchemy and supernatural
curiosities? Well, I think Newton
helped, even
though he was an alchemist and a mysticist, Newton himself, I think, played a huge role, because once he showed that the motions of the planets and the celestial objects could be understood by the same laws that governed people on Earth, and that physical effects have physical causes, that changed everything. So I think Newton himself played a key role. But of course, it evolved, and I think actually Charles Darwin played a huge role when he demonstrated that the diversity of life on Earth can and does come due to natural selection and not to design. That was a significant, and of course, it's a significant blow to religion in some sense, or at least to some people's religion, and that's why it's still got such pushback in this country today.
Well, yeah, and it must drive you completely crazy when you see certain state boards of education trying to rebrand the book of Genesis as some sort of pseudoscience or quote-unquote intelligent design and treat it with equal credibility as Darwin's theory of evolution.
I know, and when you have – what do you mean, not just state? When you have the Vice President of the United States address Congress when he's a congressperson saying that you should teach intelligent design instead of evolution, then you have to worry. When you've got a Secretary of Education whose husband at least was – who's herself is a fundamentalist and whose husband basically wanted to get rid of the teaching of evolution when he was running for governor of Michigan – you have to worry.
Yeah. Well, what would you say to those who might ask, what's the difference between scientific theory and faith or a hunch? If neither are proven, aren't they equally valid?
Well, no, because scientific theories, in fact, things don't become a scientific theory till they've been tested over and over and over again. And scientific theory, like general relativity, is the highest level of our understanding of the universe because it's been tested by experiment, and it could be wrong. So scientific theories are tested. Religious faith is not, and that's a huge difference. In fact, that's why one leads to accurate understanding of the universe and the other generally hasn't.
Right. But even still, it can be misappropriated. In the book, you take to task guys like Deepak Chopra for misinterpreting the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to justify some New Age metaphysical humbug about human consciousness influencing the physical environment. Explain for the listeners what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is and why this is not proof of conscious control of the world around us.
Well, everyone wants to use science to validate what they believe. And that's, I think, a really important thing. We all want to believe. And as Feynman said, the most important person to question is yourself. And I think that's one of the lessons from science. And we see it in the book because even great scientists were so encumbered by their beliefs that they often missed the solution that was right standing in front of their face.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Professor Lawrence Krauss, author of The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? When we come back in just a minute. Folks, whether you're starting an online business or trying to get your existing business online, GoDaddy wants to help. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures, helping customers kick ass by giving them the tools, insights, and the people to transform their ideas and personal initiatives into success. With more than 62 million domain names under management, GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar. They have award-winning 24/7 support and everything you need to build your online business. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name, and GoDaddy is trusted by 13 million customers, more than any other registrar, with big savings over the other guys. And right now, my listeners can get 30% off new purchases on GoDaddy.com by using the code KICK30 at checkout. That's GoDaddy.com, code KICK30 for 30% off. Again, GoDaddy.com and offer code KICK30. And now, back to the podcast. And in the book, you tell the stories of some of the key figures in the history of physics, Galileo, Michael Faraday, Maxwell, Einstein, Fermi, Feynman, and quite a few others. As a physicist, is there one in particular who you relate to?
Well, in some ways, as a physicist, I relate to all of them. I don't have the presumption to be any of them. I think the one that's closest is probably Feynman, maybe because I knew him.
Really?
And because he influenced the way I think about physics. But I'm not Feynman. And I think the great thing about being a scientist is that I share the story. I'm a part of the story. I make my own contributions, and we all share that same effort to go beneath the illusion and find the reality below. And I'm inspired by all of them. So it's just a fun community. And that's the other thing about science that people should realize. It's not just done by the people whose names you've heard of. It's done with baby steps and a lot of people moving along the way. And it's a wonderful community working together with people from hundreds of different countries, dozens of languages, religions, all working together. Science is an example of the fact that humans can work together.
And you do seem to have a particular affection for Michael Faraday. He pioneered electromagnetism, also made quite a few discoveries in chemistry, among many other accomplishments. As a scientist, what do you admire in particular about Faraday?
Well, I like Faraday for a large variety of reasons. One, he was a an amazing, he was not, never educated formally. He was a bookbinder's apprentice who, as I talk in the book, managed to become head of the Royal Institution and do experiments that changed the world. Radio right now, what we're doing right now would be impossible if he hadn't discovered the laws of electromagnetism. But he was also a humble man. He turned down knighthoods. And he actually, in the Royal Institution, he established these lectures. He used to give these Christmas lectures and other lectures, hundreds of lectures to the general public. And sort of that, of course, I value because I think it's really important to disseminate science.
And in telling the story of science, you describe a series of unifications in the history of physics. We already mentioned the unification of electricity and magnetism into electromagnetic force, the unification of space and time, quantum mechanics and special relativity into quantum electrodynamics, electromagnetic and weak forces into the electroweak force, and ideas to integrate the strong force at the Large Hadron Collider. Which of these do you have the hardest time explaining to laymen who don't have a physics background like myself?
Well, I think the one that is the penultimate or ultimate unification that I spend a large part of the second half of the book talking about, which is the unification of two of the four forces of nature, the electromagnetic force, which most of us are familiar with, and the weak force, which is the force that's responsible for nuclear reactions. They're very different. One operates over the scale of nuclei. One operates over the scale of the universe. They have different, very different properties. But one of the amazing things we've discovered, and this is the hallmark of progress in science, is that these two forces that look so different on the surface are really identical on below the surface. And whenever you see disparate things that appear very different on the surface, shown to be different reflections or different manifestations of the same thing, that's progress in science.
Well, tell me this, Lawrence. Is there a danger of science becoming sort of a victim of its own success in the sense that people who aren't scientists can understand and experience things that are more tangible, like magnetism and electricity, things that people kind of have a fundamental understanding of. But as science progresses and physicists like yourself push farther into the realms of particle physics, there's the possibility that the public has difficulty grasping such esoteric concepts. And maybe there's even a risk of these advances driving some people to give up trying to understand science and retreat to the relative comfort of religion and superstition. Is that a valid concern?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book too, because physics seems so far removed from people that they don't think they can ever understand it. And it's a series of steps that got us there. And I think if people review the series of steps, then they can follow that arc of discovery themselves. And you don't have to, you know, in our society, you think you have to be a scientist to appreciate science, but you don't have to think you're a musician to appreciate music or an artist to appreciate art. And I don't think you have to be a scientist to appreciate science. You can get the perspective. You don't have to be master of it, but you can understand where it comes from and how and the impact it has for our understanding of ourselves.
And since you brought up the comparisons with music and art, you know, art and science are often viewed as opposing disciplines. One is subjective, one is fixed. But you discuss the fact that you see a lot more in common between the two than most scientists are probably willing to admit, particularly in terms of the creativity aspect, I suppose.
Maybe. For me, the greatest legacy of science is its cultural legacy. Science is like art, music, literature. They all do the same thing. They change our perspective of our place in the universe. Mm-hmm. And that's the greatest virtue of science. Of course, it produces the technology that allows you and I to talk and people to live longer. And that's important, too. But its cultural legacy is equally important. And they're all valuable, which is why I'm so sad that in the current budget, they're not only just cutting science dramatically, the kind of science I talk about in the book, but the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, Corporation for Public Broadcasting. These are the things that make the country worth defending.
Well, yeah. And in a December New Yorker column, you accused Trump of waging, quote unquote, a war on science. Trump released his first budget proposal, which makes cuts to education, healthcare, and scientific research. I can only imagine how much that must alarm you. And also, as someone who deals in facts and evidence, it must worry you to see that this country is careening into a post-truth, alternative facts dark age.
Well, that's part of the reason that part of it, I think, is due to the way we teach science, or rather misteach science, or things in general at school. We teach science as if it's a collection of facts, and then other people have another set of facts. Science isn't a collection of facts. It's a process for deriving facts. Mm-hmm. That means a process for telling sense from nonsense. And that's the process that we should be teaching in school. And that's the process which, if we used in the political process, to be skeptical, base your conclusions on empirical evidence, test them. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that would help make democracy better.
Yeah, and it does seem that we do students a real disservice when our education system focuses so heavily on rote memorization and regurgitation of facts and spends not nearly enough time teaching kids simply how to reason and employ logic and the scientific method to the world around them outside of just science.
I don't think the answers are important. The facts are important. We should be teaching kids how to ask questions. I think that's really the point.
Yeah. Well, with science and science programs under assault or at the very least experiencing some pushback or disregard from the Trump administration and some in Congress, in this heated political environment, do you find a reticence on the part of your colleagues in the scientific community to jump into the political fray and speak out in defense of their work and stand up for science?
Well, I think scientists are most comfortable in the academic forums. And so scientists are, I think, like many other people, are hesitant to jump into public life, into politics, into many different things. But some scientists have to do it, I think, in order to help the public understand the perspectives. And I'm proud that a lot of scientists do.
Yeah. Well, I had Alan Ald on the show a little while ago
did an event in New York City together.
Oh, you
last
did?
Week.
Oh, yeah. He's terrific. I had him on the show.
Yeah, he's great.
And he does all kind of work to improve science communication. We talked about the fact that many people who aren't scientists have trouble understanding the benefit of some of these more advanced pursuits. You know, most people understand how all kinds of technology came out of Maxwell's unification of electricity and magnetism. But what kind of technology has come from these more recent unifications, such as special relativity, general relativity, electroweak theory, or something else that we're talking
about?
The
unification of the weak and electromagnetic interaction is not going to make a better toaster. It may have no direct implications for technology. I would argue that's not the reason to do it. It's to understand our origins. But whenever you spend a lot of money on new technology, there are always side benefits. You should never use them to judge to determine that's what you're doing. But after all, CERN, which houses the Large Hadron Collider, because of the big experiments, was the place where the World Wide Web was developed, and it's changed the world. So if you want one example of how the modern world has been changed by the efforts to push the forefront of physics, that's one.
Right. And in the book, you recall how I think it was the physicist Robert Wilson once testified in the 60s before the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy, and some senator asked him how his research would benefit national security.
And he said, it won't help defend the nation, but it'll help keep the nation worth defending.
Yeah. You talk at length about the new mysteries that the discovery of the Higgs boson particle opens up. In fact, you say if we're going to ask why do we exist, we might as well ask why does the Higgs exist? But we don't really know yet, right?
Well, we don't know at a fundamental level. We've discovered it does, and we've discovered that it completely has changed the universe so that we can exist in it. At a fundamental scale, the universe clearly isn't designed for us, because at a fundamental scale, we couldn't exist. It's because this accident that this Higgs field froze in space in the early history of the universe that allowed us to exist. But we don't know why it froze the way it did. And that's, of course, every time you make a great discovery in science, there are more questions than there are answers. And that's a great thing. That's not a bad thing, because once again, the story gets more interesting.
Do we have any ideas on that?
Of course, we got tons of ideas, but most of them are probably wrong. That's the other great thing. If you're a theoretical physicist, as I often say, the two greatest states to be in are either wrong or confused.
Well, before we go, you're the chair of the board of sponsors at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists magazine, which has been updating its annual doomsday clock every year since, I think, 1947. The Bulletin recently moved the hands on the clock, the closest it's been to midnight or doomsday in 64 years.
Yeah.
What prompted that?
Well, a lot of things. First of all, a series of very dangerous statements by now President Trump before he was inaugurated about the need to proliferate nuclear weapons and the possibility of using them. Saber-rattling by Russia, developments in North Korea, the fact that the president and Congress don't buy the reality of climate change, the new effects of cyber invasions on the democratic process, there are lots of things that are concerning us, and we point them out. And we also point out the only way we think this is going to get better is not by trusting our leaders to do it, is by the public getting interested and involved and pushing their leaders to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you sitting down with me. Again, the book is The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Why Are We Here? Lawrence Krauss, thanks for talking with me.
It's great. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Lawrence Krauss for joining me on the podcast. You can order The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? On Amazon, or download the audiobook for free with a special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. You can learn more about Lawrence Krauss and the work he's doing at krauss.faculty.asu.edu, and follow Lawrence Krauss on Twitter @LKrauss and then the number 1. And Krauss is spelled K-R-A-U-S-S. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @KickassNewsPod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickassNews or click on the donate button at KickassNews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.